This is a Saturday Night Live group of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on July 15th, year 2000. This is the 31st annual Day of Sobriety, and our first guest speaker is Jean R. of Campbell, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the Estelle Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jean. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sure everybody heard that background music over there just a moment ago. Sweet music to our ears, isn't it? Listen, first I'd like to thank Mickey for asking me to speak today. It's always a privilege to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel like I've already met some new friends here at this meeting. Danny's told me about the challenges that they've had to get this off today. And they've done a great job. And he just gave me permission just to let you guys know so you can prepare for this to speak 15 minutes longer if I want to. Yeah. I'll play it by ear. And I have to say that, you know, I'm just very, very grateful to be here today, to be sober, you know, to be amongst you guys. I'm always comfortable. It doesn't matter where I go in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I show up. I don't know some of you guys, but it doesn't matter because I always feel like I do. And, you know, I was just thinking this morning about speaking. I was thinking about, I got sober down in L.A., and I was just around a year sober the first time that I was the main speaker for a meeting. And how that happened was because my sponsor and my grand sponsor, when I turned 6 months sober, strongly suggested that I get into service. And you know how sponsors are. They're such great con artists. And so I got into service, and I actually have to say at the same time I was going through my first breakup in my first year of sobriety. But what I was doing of service is I was down at Central Office in L.A., and I was working the phones. So this particular Saturday morning I was working the phones, and my cohort in crime and the person working the phones with me just turned and said, "Hey, you know, I just became secretary of this meeting, and I need a main speaker next Saturday. Are you willing to do that?" You know, and I'd also been told you just say yes. So I said yes, and he told me where it was, and then I talked to my sponsor and my grand sponsor, and you know, asked him where the meeting was, and my grand sponsor just laughed, and he said, "Look," he said, "baby," he said, "you just show up, dress up, and there's going to be one person in the back of the room who's going to hear what you have to say. And remember, you're speaking to a group of alcoholics." And he said, "After you announce your name, most of them will go to sleep. So don't worry about it." Now, what he didn't tell me was that it was an old-timers meeting and that there were over 100 people there at this particular meeting on Wilshire Boulevard. But I showed up, and I dressed up, and I stood up. And when I got to the meeting, and it was a huge meeting. I was just terrified. I mean, I could hear my knees knocking. You know, I thought I was going to faint. And, you know, to this day, all I can tell you is one of the things that my sponsor said was, you know, just ask God to please speak through you, you know, and just, you know, let the rest happen. And I did that, but I'll swear to you, I do not remember a word hardly of what I said in that experience. And I was so relieved when it was over. But I'll tell you the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, a lot of people came up in your gracious way and thanked me for speaking in that meeting. And right towards the end of the meeting, a man and a woman came up, and they were both crying. They were both really in tears, and they just hugged me. And gosh, you know, it just touches me. I just thought about this. I hadn't thought about this for a long time. And they both said that they had just lost their daughter. Their daughter had just died, very short to that time, just in the 2 weeks prior to that. And she was my age, and her name was Jean. And that they just said how much hope that I had given them and how much healing had happened to them because of hearing me. So I understood, you know, that by showing up, that's one of the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I understood it really had nothing to do with me, that it really is in God's hands, whatever happens around here. Now, what's really funny about all of that is, you know, the next day I saw my sponsor and she said, you know, typically, she said this, the young man that had asked me to speak was a brand new secretary. He'd just been elected, and typically that they had made people have 5 years of sobriety or greater when they speak at that meeting. So I really found out that they were very patient with me and very loving with me that night. So that's exactly what I'm going to do today. I, you know, it doesn't matter if there's two people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous or over 100 or however the size is. I always ask God to please speak through me. To the most part, I truly haven't planned what I'm going to say today. I'm always kind of shocked by whatever comes out myself, and see what happens and hopefully have some fun. What it was like. Oh, and first, yeah, I just want to thank Rob and Josh. Congratulations, you know, for in your first 30 days of sobriety. It's good. It's good to see you and welcome. It's kind of a shock, isn't it, when you show up at AA in your first 30 days of sobriety. So hopefully you'll hang out and get to know us a little bit. I'm going to talk a little bit about what it was like. And qualify, but I don't have to. Hopefully, I won't spend a lot of time there these days. I really want to talk about the steps and what's going on in my life today, actually. But let me just say that I was born and I was raised in a very small rural area in the middle of the country. I was raised in a town of 2,500 in Kansas. You know, and that's really kind of funny. I remember telling somebody not long ago in Santa Cruz, she asked me, well, where I was from, and I said, well, I was from Kansas, and this blank look kind of went across her face. And I said, well, do you know where that's at? And she said, well, I sort of do. It's kind of in the middle of the country, right? And I said, yeah. So I'm from the land of Oz, and you know, I have to say that from the get-go, probably just was absolutely a terror to my parents and self-will run riot. So that's just kind of the way I popped out. I have a tremendous self-will. It kind of shocked everybody in the community where I was from, I'm sure. I would say that I was very blessed in the fact that I was raised around a huge extended family. As a matter of fact, my grandmother died about 3 years ago, and when I went back, there were like over 150 of us on both sides of my family in my near family. So, it's really kind of a clan. And alcoholism is a little bit rampant in that clan. Unfortunately, my grandfather died from alcoholism very early. I have an uncle who died from alcoholism. I think he was about 47. So, you know, I mean, I was raised with the ism around. And I also have, you know, my grandfather owned a tavern at that time. And when I say a tavern, it was actually more of a family tavern. You know, there were a lot of people in there. And, you know, one of my favorite stories is even from kindergarten, I remember, you know, I couldn't wait to get out of school. You know, I'd hit my aunt's house, eat candy bars there. I'd hit the tavern, eat a cheeseburger, and help pour beer. And I loved how that tavern felt. You know, even at that young age, I just thought it was just the coolest place. And, you know, I don't know if anybody remembers, but they had those big old schooners, you know, those big, huge, leaded glass glasses of beer. And, you know, I remember pouring those, and I thought it was just a kick. You know, and then I'd head off, have coffee and cookies with my grandmother, and I'd get home for dinner. Of course, I wasn't hungry. That's kind of my doctrination into being around booze. It seemed kind of natural to me, actually, to be around this tavern, and I actually spent quite a bit of time around there. But I would say that my first drunk was about the age of 11, and I was at my aunt and uncle's house in Colorado, and Coors beer was a big deal in those days. I don't know if everybody remembers Coors, but it was very hard to get in those days outside of Colorado in the middle of the country. But they had a big tap downstairs, and I poured myself a beer, and my brother poured a beer, my sister poured a beer. I drank my beer. They hated their beer, so I drank their beer and passed out. And just, you know, I didn't, of course, I at the time thought, God, you know, this stuff really makes you sleepy. But, you know, I drank it and I passed out and I loved it. I loved that feeling. And what else? What I have found out in sobriety is that, you know, drinking is really only a symptom of some of the deeper problems that we may have in our life. But I didn't know that at that time. You know, I just knew that there was some stuff starting to happen in my family, and there was stuff starting to happen in me that I really couldn't, talk about. So what I came to realize at a very young age, before actually the age of 11, what I came to realize was that I was gay. And that I realized that in a Methodist fundamentalist Christian family in the middle of Kansas in the 1960s. And I can tell you it wasn't a hit. It wasn't a fabulous awareness. It wasn't a lot of fun to have. It wasn't wonderful to wake up and have that thought. It's been a journey around that. But I'll have to tell you, you know, I knew that around my first drunk. You know, I was struggling with that identity. I didn't have the words. I can tell you that I'd read a couple of books. So I'd been able to identify with that word homosexual, so I kind of knew what that meant. But I really, I really didn't want to be it. That's what I can tell you. So I really started acting out a lot, and in a lot of ways, you know. And I believe myself, I was born an alcoholic with the ism. And, and I was already acting out just because of that's who I am. But I also know that, you know, I started having this secret and didn't know how to talk about it, didn't know what to do with it. And, and I did drink around it, absolutely. So, but I really had a very blessed life. I mean, other than having this dark secret hang over my life, I had a very full life. I was involved in a lot of things. I was involved in athletics. I was very competitive. My whole family is very competitive. My sister and I won the first state championship for girls in the state of Kansas in basketball. We had a great time. I was a state championship hurdler. I also won state in music. And my whole family, we just had a lot of stuff happening. But I guess when you're in Kansas, there's not a whole lot to do. So you make the best out of it, and that's kind of what we did. And I had a lot of stuff happening in my life, but there's another event that happened in my life when I was about a senior in high school, and I hurt my knee, ACL, for all of those athletes out here, completely tore my ACL, my anterior cruciate ligament. Went to the orthopedic surgeon, and after having all this success, he basically said, "Sorry, can't run anymore. It's over. You can't compete." So, you know, what my reaction to that news was, I drank. So, you know, first I had this secret, and now they're telling me I can't do what I want to go do, and my reaction to that was, well, you know, I started drinking, and I started smoking, and I really started acting out, and I liked it, and I have to say, I liked booze. I liked booze. My father taught me how to drink scotch by mixing it with 7-Up, and so I eventually got, you know, the drink of my choice was scotch and water. until, of course, the very end, and then you guys know what it's like. It's whatever is 89 cents and on sale and what's available. So so I basically went on to college, and I was really, really starting to get screwed up. You know, I started smoking hash. I started smoking pot. I started drinking all the time. I was at my first college for 6 months and decided, well, this isn't for me. I've got to try something else. So I went to a different college. And while at that college is really when I came out, if you will. I mean, I really, you know, I came out to my family that I am a lesbian. They asked me to leave home, never come back. So it was not, you know, a fun time. And I was also surrounded by a lot of people who, you know, quite didn't know how to hang on to that information. And I'll tell you this, I didn't know how to deal with that information. So, you know, Scotch seemed like a really good idea. And so I really started drinking. But at that time, I don't believe I was an alcoholic. But I was definitely having problems. And I was binge drinking a lot, but I wasn't passing out, and I don't believe I had crossed the line. So I went on to finish college. I did graduate in 4 years, which was a miracle because it was my fourth college. And you guys know how it is. You know, you get so uncomfortable. I was so uncomfortable with myself internally and inside. I mean, I really had to start doing geographics to keep things moving so that you guys really didn't know who I was. And I can't say as I really wanted to know too much about who you were either. And at the whole time, I was starting to go to gay bars, which is really an underground way of drinking. It was a wild time during the disco days and Donna Summer, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff happening. And I have to say, it was sort of cool. I was having a fun time until one of the bars I was in was raided. And, you know, here I am in Wichita, Kansas, in a gay bar with televisions. And, you know, and I just thought, God, this is starting to look strange. But of course it didn't stop me. And after I graduated from college, I went on to graduate school at the University of Kansas. And then I thrived. I mean, then I found my kind. I found a gay community, and that was just totally cool. I also found my kind because I started working in a liquor store part-time as I started going to school. And that was totally cool. And I mean, it was just a wild time. And the guy that owned this liquor store had been a Vietnam vet, and he was definitely PTSD, and he had a lot of stuff happening. And today I know that about him. But then he was just a maniac. I remember one day he came in, he had had a beard, mustache, right, and it was all fried off. His whole face was burned. And he said, he laughed about it and said he'd been doing jelly beans and lighting jelly beans, which is a fiery drink, and he happened to miss. So it was really a wild time, but I loved it because, we could go to the back, easily get anything we wanted. And, of course, I was stealing like crazy at that time. I mean, how can you work in a liquor store and not steal? It's beyond me. So my drinking really started rocketing, kind of took off at that point. And here I am. I'm one of the first teaching assistants at the university. So I'm teaching at KU. I'm a graduate student there. And then I landed a job not close, fairly close by at a private college. And I'm a head women's tennis coach at this college. And it's really funny because the president of that college, before he gave me the job, met with me one night, and he said, rules that I had to follow if I wanted the job, though, was I had to quit my job at the liquor store. And, I was devastated. I remember thinking, I really have to think about this. And I told him that, and I think he was floored that I was so honest. But what does that have to do with anything exactly? But it didn't catch my attention. But it really bugged me. It really, really bugged me. And so I did quit. And it wasn't long. And I went on. And by the way, I went on, and I was very successful. You know, that's part of my, I mean, I became a very successful coach at that time, and I was only 21, I guess. Won a state tournament, went to a regional tournament, first round nationals. So, you know, I mean, on the outside it was looking very good. On the inside, though, you know, my partying was just increasing. And then the third event in my life, which really, which happened, and I think for women alcoholics, I noticed that often women that I meet, we start drinking around traumatic events. Not always, you know. My grand sponsor was a drunk housewife, I think. But even she talks about a traumatic event that happened in her life when her drinking escalated. But I was 25. It was 1981, and I was attacked on the University of Kansas campus by somebody who harmed me. I'll put it that way. Really harmed me. Tried to kill me, actually. And it was just a bad, bad scene. And this gentleman had harmed other women, and it was devastating. So I worked with the DA's office, and I went to trial. I went to trial, and it was just, you know, my reaction to that was I went out, I bought a fifth of scotch, and I drank that fifth of scotch, and I'll tell you that I drank like that for the next 6 years. I drank on a daily basis. You know, I drank with bitterness and hate and anger, and I hated you, and I blamed you, and a lot of stuff. So that really, that, you know, that happened. And I went through this trial, and this gentleman was put in prison, which, you know, that really didn't help, I have to tell you, because, you know, I was nuts. I just have to say, I just went absolutely crazy nutso. So not only, you know, was I dealing with my own sexual and spiritual identity, right, and who I was in the world, and but to have this happen was just, it was just beyond anything that I could ever even imagine. And, you know, even it took me, actually, I have to say this, it took me almost 10 years to even have a full memory, you know, of what happened around that. So there was a lot of stuff that happened. But after I went through that trial, I moved to another state. I became a coach, a women's coach, in one of the SUNY schools in New York. And my drinking just, you know, just took off. And, you know, I was doing nutsy, crazy things. And I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand myself from the inside out. I couldn't sleep. I was definitely PTSD. You know, it was just an amazing thing to me that I could even keep moving. But I did. But I decided after a year and a half of that I couldn't take that anymore. So I ended up going to a college in Colorado. And, you know, at that point, then I started having eating problems. So I was having sleeping problems. I was drinking like a fool. And I was starting to have eating disorders and problems. And really just kind of imploding, I guess. Well, and when I was at that job, basically somebody who, you know, somebody who was an authority figure in the college, a man that I worked with, told me that he loved me, and that's all it told me. That's all it took for me to quit that job and move to the next one. And I was there for a year. And, you know, at that time, I read a book by John Nesbitt called Megatrends. And I just decided, you know, I've got to get out of this education stuff. This is not right, you know. And really, it took me a long time to understand that I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, I couldn't show up and pretend to be somebody when I was just dying inside, you know. So I made a really brilliant move at that point. I moved to Southern California, and I got into business. And the area of business I got into was software sales, and I found you guys again. You know, because if there was any area, I would say that of probably out of the 20 people in my first job I worked with, half of us were alcoholics and addicts. So I felt like I was at home. You know, at that time we got paid to party. So, you know, you did well. I remember one of the first times that I met one of those goals, I got a case of Dom Perignon. Now, I'll tell you, that's right. But, you know, us alcoholics, right, I got so ripped that night, so very ripped that night. I ended up waking up in the morning and remembering that I left that Dom Perignon out in my car. So I went out in the back of my car, and, of course, it had exploded in the night. All six bottles all over my car. I was devastated. You know, that hurt me much worse than the money that I'd made on that bonus. I was just, I couldn't believe it. And, you know, and I was doing things like I went out on a date one night, went to a Super Bowl party, and I acted, of course, as the bartender. And on the way home, just, you know, vomited on somebody's brand new car all the way home. Got there, you know, barely lived through the night. Showed up at the Super Bowl party the following day, could not even move, you know. And it was astounding because the person's car I threw up on said, you know, how much fun they had had and would I like to go out again? So that should tell you about, you know, the kind of people I was hanging out with. And we, you know, we were all nuts. And so a couple of things started happening, and now I'll start moving towards recovery, thank God. So a couple of things started happening. One, the Thanksgiving before I got sober, my mother had a big meeting, called us all home. We came home, and she basically told us that she was a Valium addict and that she was going to stop. Well, that was just amazing to me because I knew my mother had always been, my mother and I had been at odds my whole life. We just were oil and water. And, you know, her kind of raging and, I can just say that there were things that I noticed about her, but it was kind of, you know, addiction is a little bit different than alcoholism. You know, pills are a little bit more quiet, and you can't find them. They're just not as noisy as alcoholics. But anyway, she called us home and said she was quitting, and I really noticed that. I mean, I paid attention to that because everybody had said, you know, I was like my mother. So, you know, that sort of bugged me. Not long after that, I started having an affair with someone who was in relationship who I should not be having an affair with, you know, and that... My behaviors had been changing over the years, certainly, and I noticed that. And then another thing that happened that kind of started me towards recovery was that a very large company, acquired this little company I was with. And somehow in that transition, they changed my salary and they increased it almost five times what it should be. You know, so I got my first paycheck, and see, you guys know. I got my first paycheck, and I thought, oh, this is a mistake, but God, this is great. I mean, I called everybody. We went down to the bar, and I bought shots all night. I mean, I spent a lot of that check in one night buying shots. And, you know, I just thought, well, they'll catch it. You know, I just don't think I'm going to say anything about this right at this point. And so, you know, 3 months later, I mean, I thank God for that because, you know, I really believe that that check really accelerated my drinking. I mean, I was making so much money that wasn't mine. I was just, I mean, it just, I took off. And I really partied it all away. And it wasn't long after that, about 3 months after that, you know, the boss that I had at the time pulled me into his office and said, you know, Jean, we've noticed that we've been paying you this salary. I said, yeah, I noticed that too. And he said, didn't you ever think about telling anybody about that? I said, no, not really. You know, and I really got arrogant. You know how we get. I really got arrogant and said, basically, you know, Phil, this, I'm sorry, this was your problem. This wasn't my problem. This was your problem. And he said, well, Jean, it just became your problem. Because you're going to have to pay this back. Now, today, by our Silicon Valley standards, perhaps it's not that great since, you know, a lot of stuff's happened. But, you know, the amount that it came out to be was $10,000. So, basically, I was, you know, I'll tell you this. That $10,000 was my first financial amends in recovery. It took me a year to pay it off, but I did. And then they promoted me. I love how business thinks. So that kind of caught my attention. And there was another thing. I'd started dating someone in the Sioux. I started dating a woman who was a year sober. And she told me, I'm an alcoholic, I'm in recovery. Do you have a problem with that? And I said, no. As a matter of fact, congratulations. I mean, I think it's so great you're getting help. I'd love to support you. I'll be happy to go to a meeting. So that's how I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And even though I have an uncle who's in his 39th year of sobriety and who was very involved with AA in my hometown, I had no idea that I was an alcoholic. Like 2 years before this, I had had the thought that if I kept drinking like this, I would become an alcoholic. But alcoholism was not in my head, and I did not know anything about AA. So that's how I got to my first meeting in West Hollywood of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, I don't remember it. All I remember is I went to that meeting. I thought it was just weird as heck. And I smoked a pack of Marlboros as soon as I got out of that meeting. So I must have heard something. So I started showing up at meetings in that way, but I was clueless that it had anything to do with me. I love denial. Don't exactly know I'm lying. I absolutely had not a clue I was an alcoholic. Until one day, of course, I was walking out of a meeting and somebody there handed me one of those dang 20 question tests. And I don't know if anybody's taken those 20 questions, but I took it. And I remember one night I got really drunk, and of course my phone bill always increased dramatically after I started drinking. So I called a friend of mine in Phoenix, Mary O'Sullivan. I said, look, I've got this 20 question test and I'm going to take it. And she said, I want to talk to you about it. And I said, well, why? And she said, well, just call me after you take it. So you know what? I took that test. And I was probably so loaded, I didn't know that I needed to lie on it. So I didn't. I didn't lie, and I took that test, and at the end of that test, I got 17 yeses. And then I looked at the bottom and saw that it only took 3 to be an alcoholic. And there's something, just a little inch of something that got into my head that was like, ooh. Oh, this is a problem. So I called her back, and I said, all right, I just took this test. And she said, how'd you do? And I said, man, I got 17. She said, yeah, boy, you have a problem. And I said, you know, why did you tell me to call you back? And she said, well, I took that test in high school. I said, you got to be kidding. How'd you do? And she said, I flunked it then. I thought, God, this isn't good. And I have to say, even though I make light of it, just like you guys know, my life was a mess. I mean, it was a mess. I mean, I was in bad trouble. I hadn't been taking care of myself for years. You know, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. You know, I was barely showing up at work. I owed people money. I just felt like, this alcoholism thing was getting out of hand. And I really didn't know what to do. And one night, you know, my moment of clarity is one night before I got sober, the night before my natal birthday, I went out and I drank a fifth of scotch, I drank a pint, and I didn't get drunk. I was talking with Sue that night, and I told her all of my, for the first time I told somebody all my secrets. I talked about all of my bitterness and all of my hate, and then I had that moment of clarity that said to me, I heard the voice say, if I didn't stop drinking, my life wouldn't change. And in that moment, these two things came together, that my life was unmanageable completely and had been for years, and that it had something to do with drinking. So that was it. I went to my birthday party the next day. There was booze everywhere, and I didn't drink. And that was my first day of sobriety on May 8th in 1987. And I tried doing Alcoholics Alone for 30 days, and I was nuts. I wanted to kill you, kill me, but I didn't. And at the end of the 30 days sober, I was planning the party I was going to have to celebrate, which caught my attention. But I didn't. And instead, I went to a meeting, and Jack with red glasses asked me to stand up and read how it works. And I stood up in front of that meeting, and I said, "My name's Jean. I'm an alcoholic." And that was the first time I'd said that. And then it was, you know, I knew it was over. And in my first 60 days, I got my first sponsor. It was a beautiful woman that had been going to the meetings, Joan Ashby. Joan died when I was 5 years sober, and she died sober. But she had been drinking in Hollywood for 40 years, and she got sober. And, you know, she was only 6 months further ahead than I was. But I'll have to tell you, you know, when I was in my first 60 days sober, I wouldn't even talk to anybody that had over 90 days. I mean, if you had a year, you were just way too intimidating for me. So, you know, I latched on to Joan, and that was one of the biggest decisions of my life because, you know, I had never in my whole life, no matter what had happened and what I'd gone through, no matter, I had never, not once, ever asked for help. And that's just, you know, isn't that just incredible? I mean, I tried to do it all myself, all my whole life. It didn't even ever occur to me, even after, you know, some of the painful things I'd been through, to ask for help. But I did. And I was sweating bullets, and I thought she'd say no, but of course she said yes. She'd work with me, and she got me my first big book and 12 steps. And, you know, that was it. We started working the steps. And my first step I took, you know, and I am powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. And I understood that once I took the first drink, that I was just not the same. That I ended up doing things, you know, that first drink just killed me. And no matter how educated I was, when an old timer in my first 90 days told me it was the first drink that got me drunk, and that, you know, if an alcoholic has one drink, their life changes. That was the most important information in my whole life. I mean, it didn't even ever occur to me that it was the first drink that got me drunk. I always thought it was the 20th. So, you know, that was a revelation. And, you know, there's something beautiful about staying sober. If you stay sober long enough, you know, you only have one option, and that's to keep moving. You know, I mean, I was hurting so bad inside without booze. And what it really made me see was how crazy, crazy, crazy I was and how crazy, crazy, crazy my life had been. And so I worked the first step with Joan and understood that I can't drink. She started talking to me about the disease of alcoholism. And my life was unmanageable. I believed, you know, I'd had enough, I'd have enough validation about that. My life had been unmanageable for a long time, you know, and so she just had me write down the events, you know, of things that had happened in my life that maybe normally wouldn't have happened if I wasn't drinking. And she actually asked me to write down my drunkalogue, and that was just, I was floored. I had no idea that alcohol had been such a big part of my life. So it drove me into step two. Came to believe that a power greater than myself and that ourselves can restore us to sanity. And, you know, it's the first time I had to look at my life and the insanity, not soundness of mind that I had lived in, doing things over and over and expecting different results. But I basically took this step with the meetings of alcoholics because, you know, what I'm starting to realize in Alcoholics Anonymous is how much I hated God. You know, I had hated God for, you know, putting me in the middle of Kansas and making me gay. I had hated God because of, you know, being attacked and harmed by another human being to such a great degree that I had been. I hated God for giving me a family that, you know, had kicked me out. I mean, I hated God for all of those things. So, you know, thank God that in step two, all I had to believe was that you guys were here and that you love me. And that's all that I needed. And that I just didn't have to act the way I used to act, which pushed me into step three. And became willing to turn my will and our lives over to the care of God as I understand God. And see, I think that there's a reason, a divine reason. There is a divine reason that that very sentence is the only sentence that's underlined in the steps. Because I didn't have to have the Methodist God. I didn't have to have a straight God. I didn't have to have the God of my parents. I didn't have to have the God of my sponsor. I mean, it's the first time in my life that I felt like that I could have a God that was a caring God. And that's what I did, and I wrote a third step on God. And for the first time, my first third step was simply that I admitted to my sponsor how much I hated God. And my sponsor gave me permission to tell God to fuck off. And after a meeting, we did that. We jumped up and down outside of a meeting in Westwood, and I told God, fuck off. And we all laughed and we cried, and then I started having a better relationship with God because I wasn't struck down. I lived through it, and that's all I needed. So my first four step was about 25 pages long, and my sponsor just said, write down everybody you've ever met. So that's what I did. We didn't follow the book. I just wrote down everybody I'd ever met and what they had done to me. And I wrote down how much I hated them and resented them. And then slowly, slowly, very gently, my sponsor took me through and showed me a little bit about my part in that action. But I couldn't get a lot of my part in that action right off the bat. But what I did do was get all of that crap out. And what she did for me was she gave me all the crap she had lived through. And, we were similar, and a lot of healing took place. You know, she didn't kick me out. She loved me. She was there for me. And how she started showing me that it's our similarities, not our differences. And just a big healing around the fourth step and the fifth step for me. And then the sixth and seventh step were very painful because after I dumped all of that, then I really started getting that, I am really angry. And my glaring defects of character in my first year were just painful. I don't know about you guys, but God, I was acting out all over the place. I was not showing up at work. I was still lying. I was cheating on my expense reports. I was pretty much stuff. But the beauty of 6 and 7 is I did write them out, and I did work them with her, and I ended up at the Tropicana on a business trip. And when I got over there, I went through the lobby, and everybody in the lobby was drunk. And I went to my room, and the phone was turned off, and I was just panicked because it's the first trip I'd made in sobriety. And, how it is. Like, you got to have the phone in that line to AA. But I ended up calling my sponsor, and we talked that night. And, that night I was sitting there, and all of a sudden the room turned a different color, and this thought came in my mind, first time in my whole life, nobody had ever made me pick up a drink. I was floored by that information. I mean, I knew you guys were to blame for something. Yeah, and I got it, Danny was saying earlier, in my innermost self, I got that I had part, nobody had ever made me drink. And following that mind-blowing information is nobody had ever made me rage. Nobody had ever made me harm another person. So that was my sixth and seventh, and then just trying to change my behavior. I did step eight, I wrote down the list, and I became ready because I was sweating bullets. I don't know about you, my first step eight, I was just panicked. I mean, thank God it's kind of, you don't have to, bulldoze right into nine. Because after I wrote down that list, it started becoming clear to me I was going to have to make amends to people. And I was terrified by that. But my sponsor basically, when we got into step nine, basically went through each and every one of them, and I didn't owe amends to all of them. So thank God, do that step with your sponsor. But, we did go over one at a time how to make the amends and, to remind me of the exact nature of my harms and wrongs. And, I'll have to say that the first amends that I make was to somebody who I'd hurt very, very, very deeply, and I knew that. But the response I got was beautiful. it was beautiful. And you know, that moment just transformed my whole life, and the promises started coming true for me. You know, I wasn't as bad as I thought I was, and I had done harms. And, you know, I could start making restitution. So that $10,000 was paid off in my first year of sobriety. I made amends to my parents. I started making amends to the, I can't even tell you how many lovers that I'd had, both sides of the street on that one, and the jobs that I had had. And I just slowly started making an amends. And after that point, the job that I was with that promoted me after I paid off the $10,000 transferred me down to San Diego, and I moved down there and met my next sponsor, Joan S., who's 44 years sober. And she took me through steps 10, 11, and 12. And, you know, and I understood, at you know, that 10, 11, and 12 really was about, you know, on a daily basis, trying to, you know, find some emotional sobriety in the program and to keep being of service and to show up and to strengthen my relationship with God. And I also have to say that really what saved my life were the old timers. My grand sponsor, I you know, I'm just going to be honest with you guys. You know, as a gay woman in, as a lesbian in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've had to tweak the rules a little bit. My grand sponsor in L.A. was a gay man, Donald. And, you know, so I have shared that from the podium, and I know somebody came up to me once and said, isn't that a problem, being sponsored by a man? So at that point, it wasn't a problem being sponsored by a man. It was important in my life. And, you know, the sponsors that I had, and by the way, I need to say this too, the first meetings that I went to were in West Hollywood. I went to the 5 o'clock happy hour, and West Hollywood's a very gay community, and thank God they were there, because I hated straight people so bad when I got sober, I don't think I would have gotten sober other than if I wouldn't have found my own to get sober with. So they really held me long enough until Donald forced me to go to the Friendly House, which is a women's meeting, when I was a year sober. And I begged him, please, 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 please don't make me go. And he said, all right. I said, all right, how long do I have to go? And he said, look, you can stop going when you want to be there. And I thought, you know, this really sucks. These guys really hit all the angles. So I ended up going to the Friendly House in L.A., and a friend of his, Peggy, ran the Friendly House, and I started going to women's meeting and doing some healing. And by the time I got down to San Diego, I started going to mixed meetings, which was a big deal for me. And after San Diego, I was moved to Dallas, Texas, where, you know, was an astounding move to me. I was surrounded by people with big hair and Cadillacs. They told big stories. My sponsor there, Catherine, she was an Amazon. She was 6 foot with big hair that made her look 6'5". And she was just a wild woman. And I loved her to death. And she dragged me all over Dallas. And, you know, we did meetings there. And then not soon after that, I moved here to the Bay Area, and I've been here since 1990. And, you know, since I've been here, I've had the opportunity to have Diane as my sponsor and to be able to work through the steps. Now, I'm here to tell you right now that I'm on step 6 and 7. And, you know, I'm letting go of something. What I'm letting go of is fighting anyone and anything in my life. I just went through a reorganization where I work, and I hate it. And there's part of it, you know, there's stuff about change that still bugs me. But I'll tell you, my response to the steps today is that they're a fabulous roadmap for me, and I don't stop working steps. So, you know, a couple of things have come up in the last weeks. They've called beyond the step 10. They've called me back to step 4. But I didn't wait. You know, that's what's new in my life today. You know, there's some stuff that came up. It was painful. I knew I had to take a look at my side, clean it up. And so, you know, I called Diane on a Sunday and say, let's do steps. and I wrote them out and met with her on Tuesday and did steps 1 through 7. And now I realized last night at 2 o'clock when I woke up with all this stuff on my mind, because I still carry stuff that it takes me a while to surrender. So, that I realize that it's time to do step 8 and 9 and, to keep moving and not to slow down, but to do the next part. And that's my program. The old timers taught me very early on that service is important, and I do the same thing that I did then. I go to meetings. I sponsor people. I do the steps. I have a sponsor. I have a service commitment. Even though my life is very busy right now, I'm part of a, and it's very exciting, I have to say. I've been given an opportunity to do some challenging things, some fun things. And so I'm with a young, growing company that's really doing a lot of things. Now, one of the things I do want to mention that came up today, because I thought about this morning too. In, I can't remember, in 1993, I went back to school. And this last June, a year ago, I graduated with a master's in counseling. I put myself, I put myself through school like you guys taught me how to do, one step at a time. And I'm also a licensed psychotherapist intern in the state of California. And what I want to say is that all of my biggest secrets, all of those biggest ouchies, have indeed become my biggest assets. Even things that were undreamed, that I thought, this will never heal. How can this ever heal? Not only has it healed, it has become just like what you guys have told me, probably the biggest thing that I can pass on to other men and women that I work with. Now, right now, I do have goals. You guys have taught me about goals. I'm going to, I just signed a 2-year commitment to do this thing with this company, but I do eventually want to have my own practice and do some things that I, that I hope that I get the chance to do. And, and it's a privilege. But on a daily basis, the tools that you guys have given me help me. I can't even tell you. I'm in board meetings now where this one's really helped me lately. Principles over personalities. I have to remember that. I have to show up, and when I'm in great fear, I'm being stretched a lot personally and professionally right now, and I have to show up. And instead of, standing in the room and being afraid of what's happening, what you guys taught me to do is go put my hand out to somebody who looks as scared as I do. So I do that, and a lot of my fear vanishes, and I keep, moving through that. But I still think that the biggest tool that I have, and my parents were just here for a week. I invited them to come out and play with me for a week. So here are these parents, who asked me never to come back again, who are now in my life, who are pretty good buddies, that just spent a week with me, and we played hard. We really played a lot. It was a lot of fun. I think they had a lot of fun, other than I took my mother to the IMAX right after we ate dinner, and that was sort of messy. She did tell me, please don't make me do that again. But I had this family back, and I'll tell you that over the holidays, too, this was very touching for me. Even this heals. Over the holidays, I went back to this little town, and my sister, who is a fundamentalist Christian, and who is the exact, she and I could not be farther apart, politically, spiritually. But we've made a decision, right, that love is more important. So we don't talk politics. We don't talk religion. We just show up and we love each other. And we talk about the things that we can talk about. So I showed up and I went to her little church. And her son, my nephew, who's 17, asked me, he leaned over and he said, Aunt Jean, he said, will you take communion with us? So on Christmas Eve this year, I took communion with my sister's family for the first time in a church since I came out at 18. Now, these are fundamentalist Christians. They know who I am. They know I'm gay. And it was one of the most beautiful and moving moments that I've ever experienced. And they just loved me. And I looked at them, and I saw all of our similarities, not our differences. And, that's a pretty miraculous thing. That's pretty cool. And, you know, I really am one of them today. And I can't tell you how much I look forward to going back there and spending time with them. It's been a beautiful thing. And I'm just thrilled. I mean, you know, how could we beat living in the Bay Area other than our mortgage payments? But there's a lot about living here. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, I've traveled a lot. I go to AA meetings a lot. You know, we can't beat it here. I mean, it's just terrific that we have so much available to us. And just like I was, you know, years ago, the most important thing for me is that I am sober today. I wake up, I say my prayers, and that's the first thing that comes out of my mouth on a daily basis. Thank you, thank you, thank you for keeping me sober. You guys have been very patient. You've listened very well this Saturday afternoon, and I thank you very much for letting me share.